very simply. And the basic idea is that all of the words that are used of wine and strong drink are found in the Bible in both a bad sense and in a good sense. So let that register. Let that register in your minds that when we read the passages in the Bible, both old and new, about wine, we find some of those passages in a good sense and some of them in a bad sense. So that we're left with a situation that one can, if he chooses, go into the Scriptures and he can gather all the passages that speak of them in a good sense, and then he can say, okay, see, I can drink all the wine and liquor and all that stuff I want to because, see, the Bible speaks of it in a good sense. Or someone can go and get all the passages that condemn the idea and speak of it in a bad sense and say, no, no, that's wrong, and I'm not going to do that, and you shouldn't do it either. And so they square off with each other. Well, now, we can't do the Bible that way. We cannot deal with this subject or any other subject until we have discovered a way to explain all of the verses, both pro and con. You see, we can't have the Bible contradicting itself. Because if we have the Bible contradicting itself, then we have God contradicting Himself. We have the Holy Spirit contradicting Himself. And if we have that, then the Bible is not inspired, and we might as well reject the book and forget the whole thing. So if we're going to maintain that the Bible is inspired of God, then we're going to have to seek for a solution. And there is one at hand. Now, there were several quotations this morning that I read to you, and I'm going to look at just a few of those that I was looking at this morning. Some quotations. So let me get these here ready to show you. All right. Now, there are two facts that stand out when we examine the evidence regarding wine. In the first place, there is a range of meaning or a range of fermentation in the subject. Let me just show you on the chart here. Bible wine had a range of fermentation from none to moderate. Now that fact immediately suggests a solution to the fact that there are passages that condemn the drinking of this substance and there are passages that speak of it as a blessing. If we're talking about the substance that has a great deal of fermentation, therefore a strong alcoholic content, then it is something that is condemned for us to drink. But if it is grape juice with little or no alcoholic content in it, then it is a blessing. We looked at several passages that I'm not going to take the time to go back into. Matthew 9:17, where the word obviously refers to fresh grape juice as that which is put into a new wineskin. And then we've got the opposite in Ephesians 5:18, where Paul writes, "Be not drunk with wine." So there you have the good and the bad. But perhaps the solution is we're dealing with a range of fermentation here. Therefore, in all passages where we read of oinos in a good sense, that's the word for wine in the New Testament, there is the possibility that it refers to the fresh grape juice. And in all passages where we read of it in a negative sense, there is the possibility that it refers to the fermented grape juice. So you have, really, in a way, two different substances here, depending on the range of fermentation that is involved. Note these facts on the storage of wine. We looked at this morning briefly. In a book detailing the excavations of Old Testament Gibeon, a city of the Old Testament, it was described how the ancient Canaanites kept their grape juice stored underground in large jars. A layer of olive oil was poured on top of the wine at the neck of the jar. The ancients did not understand the connection of bacteria with fermentation, but they knew the effects and how to counteract them. Now, this is important evidence because it shows that there was a feeling among many of the ancients that this substance, grape juice, can become a dangerous substance. And therefore, it was important to them to seek to preserve it as nearly to what it was when it came out of the grape as possible. In a book by E.J. Holmyard, History of Technology, he writes that the ancient world had methods for preserving juice, clay stoppers of amphorae. Now, the amphorae, I explained this morning, that's the plural word for these large jars that had a neck, and then it kind of went out like this and came down to a point. They would be stored in wooden racks with circles so that the bowl or the jar would sit in it like that. So, that's what it's talking about here. Clay stoppers of amphorae were sealed with pitch, rosin, gypsum, or coated with oil to keep out the air. Again, we're just looking at some of the abundant evidence that the ancients were concerned with preserving the grape juice. Means for preserving grape juice were well known. An ancient work, a Latin work by Cato, has this recipe. If you wish to have grape juice, meaning fresh grape juice, all year, put grape juice in an amphora and seal the cork with pitch. Sink it in a fish pond. After 30 days, take it out. It will be grape juice for a whole year. This is from the Zondervan Pictorial Bible Dictionary. The idea being that when you put that in a body of water, down on the bottom of that body of water, the water is cool down there. And it will cool the grape juice to the point that it will then keep. Of course, wine was stored in wineskins also, and when it was, it tended to ferment more. Therefore, greater care would have had to be taken in how it was drunk than if it were fresh. There is another point that comes to my mind that I need to stress, and I need to make sure everyone understands it, and that is that one of the problems in our dealing with the subject of wine is we're taking the word wine as we use it today in our modern age, in our country and in other countries of the world, and we are taking the meaning of wine today and imposing that on the substance found in the Bible. And that is simply not accurate. The wines such as we drink today are almost universally conceived to be alcoholic. And yet in the New Testament, I quoted from Barnes' notes this morning to the effect that the word oinos included grape juice, and that was the preferred drink. Actually, you had two groups of people. There were those who wanted the fresh grape juice. And when they gathered their grapes and pressed the juice from it, then they tried their best to keep it fresh. Why? Two reasons. One, they liked the taste of fresh grape juice. Secondly, they knew the dangers that would come when that substance began to ferment. So you had people who wanted to preserve it and keep it to avoid the dangers of the alcohol. Then you had people who wanted to seek out the fermented wine so that they could get the alcoholic content. I told you this morning about when I was a teenager, that I was, and that was, I know, you know, I'm constantly amazed at people when they think, when was he ever a teenager? It was right after the Civil War. Well, I was a teenager and I was gathering pecans for this man, making a little bit of money, and I went into one of his storage buildings for something and get a sack or something like that. I went in there and I found this jar, a fairly large jar, and it was sitting there where the sun could shine on it some, and I thought, boy, that looks weird, and I found out that it was his wine that he was fermenting. Now, when I saw that, I thought, wow, this is strange. We don't ever keep our grape juice in a barn outside. You know, in my family, if we had grape juice, it was in the refrigerator. So I was very puzzled why this man would have the bottle sitting out there in his barn. You know why? He was wanting it to ferment. He was wanting the alcohol to be in it. So just as today we have two different kinds of people, people who want to stay away from that alcohol because of the dangers of it, and then you have people who seek it out. So that was the case back here also. And this evidence we're looking at here is proof that there were people back there who wanted to keep the alcohol out of it. Now this brings us to the point we were this morning. Not only do we have these facts about the storage of the grape juice, but we have these facts regarding the way it was drunk. So, we've really got two things going here that will help us to understand why we have passages condemning the use of wine, and we have passages approving the use of wine. The first one we've already looked at. There was a range of fermentation from little or none, on the one hand, to maximum, as much as could be, on the other hand. Well, that would make a big difference in whether this is recommended or not. Then the second thing is the way it was drunk. There was a great difference in the way it could be drunk. The wine, as we noted before, was stored in pointed jugs, pointed on the bottoms, called amphorae, and from these jugs was poured into large bowls called craters, or it looks like craters, but anyway, it doesn't matter, it's the Greek word, where it was mixed with water. Greek for unmixed or pure is akratos. Then it was poured into cups. Now look at that for a moment. The wine stored in the amphorae. And then it was poured from these large jars into bowls. And from the bowls, it was mixed with, or in the bowls, it was mixed with water. And then it was poured into cups. Now that's the way it was served. Look at this quotation. This one comes from William Stearns Davis in his book entitled A Day in Old Rome. And periodically, I want to remind you, see, he's not a preacher. Because there tends to be a suspicion, oh, you preachers just make that up because you don't want people drinking wine. Well, that depends on which preacher you are. You can find a lot of preachers that'd be willing to just share the drink with you. Preachers in a lot of denominations, they don't have a bit of problem with that. But this is not a preacher here. This is just a guy who wrote a book about Rome, and he didn't care whether people drank or didn't drink. That was not an issue with him. Here, he is merely reporting the fact. And he says, in any case, only sheer barbarians will drink their wine undiluted, and really good wine can stand as much as 8 parts of water to one of itself without losing too much flavor. Boy, when you think about that, that kind of puts a little bit of a different light on things. What they did in ancient times was that they just commonly mixed water with the wine. Now, why did they do that? They did it to reduce the effects of whatever alcohol might be in the wine. You see, I said this morning, they had no way of knowing for sure. They didn't have the storage methods we have today. So even though they tried to do their best to keep it fresh, how would they know how fresh it was? Perhaps the taste would be their only guide. So it was a standard procedure for them to mix water. Now, you know, I read this, and I read quite a few other quotations on this from books and so on, and I got to thinking, 8 parts of water to 1 part of wine? So I got to thinking, how could I kind of try that out? Well, I didn't use any alcoholic wine, but I got some just grape juice, Welch's grape juice, the red Welch's grape juice. And I poured some in a glass, and then I put an equal amount of water in it, and I was absolutely amazed at how little that water added changed its taste. So that I actually tried out what it was saying here about mixing the water with it. And I found that you can mix a considerable quantity of water with it without substantially altering the taste. So they found that out. And they knew that the water would dilute the alcohol, whatever alcohol there might be in it. Now then, as we go along, you're going to see there is a tremendous amount of information on this very point, that the wine was mixed with water. So bear that in mind. The same writer, William Stearns Davis, says that it was common to pick a rex, which is Latin for king, a rex or lord of the revels. That potentate would have been obligated to decide how much water was to be mixed with the wine. So if you're going to have a party like that, and you've got a Rex or Lord of the party who decides, hey, let's don't put much water in it, then you know you're going to have a real good time at that party until everybody gets drunk and falls out on the floor. But if he says, no, we want to be responsible about this, let's mix a large quantity of water with it, then it could be a safe drink for them. In a book by Alfred Duggan, merely entitled The Romans, he writes that the Roman army was followed by mule trains which carried sacks of wheat for the porridge that fed the Roman armies and skins of wine mixed with, quote, great quantities of water. You notice a number of these books are books about the Romans. That's how I came to read these books, reading books about the Romans. And so I just found these things. I want you to understand this is not some prejudicial stuff that I went and found out and it's not really true. I just sort of made it up to strengthen my case. No, I found this material when I wasn't even looking for it. I was reading and I came across this material. Much of this material that I am sharing with you, I came across in that manner. In the Odyssey, Homer mentions a ratio of 20 to 1. Now, I think that probably was not common by any means, but it still adds to the point we're making. In the first century, Pliny, in his work on natural history, refers to the mixture in the same district as 8 to 1. The fullest source of information is Athenaeus, who in his The Learned Banquet quotes earlier writers who spoke of mixtures of 3 to 1, 4 to 1, 5 to 2, and he called 3 to 2 strong. Now this fellow, you can say his name however you want, Menesthus of Athens observed, mix it half and half and you get madness, unmixed bodily collapse. Now these were not Christians. These were not preachers. They were just people who lived in their society and recognized that this grape juice can be a dangerous substance. And if one does not observe cautions in using it, it can destroy him. Those who observed the cautions could drink it without damage to themselves or anyone else. But if they did not observe those cautions, then it could destroy them, their lives, could make them drunk, and so on. Now, one reason why I'm looking at this is because I want you to see how widespread this was. And in fact, this next quotation is one of the most impressive to me. Plutarch. And let me tell you where I got this. I got this in reading a book by Will Durant, one of the great historians of the 20th century. And here is a man who was a humanist, and so he sure was not giving me a quotation to help me out in my work as preacher. He was just reporting the facts. So he quoted Plutarch. Early in the second century, he said, we call a mixture wine, although the larger of the components is water. Now, you know when I told you that that word translated wine in the New Testament, oinos, that it doesn't use, when it's translated wine, it doesn't mean what we think of as wine today. People that drink wine today do not commonly mix it with water. And the wine they drink is three or four times as strong, often at least, as Bible wines were. So Plutarch says, he substantiates that idea. We call a mixture wine, although the larger of the components is water. In both the Greek and Roman world, to drink unmixed wine was considered intemperate. Now, I'm not going to keep on with this, but just look. Here we could quote from the Talmud about Jewish practice. Here's Justin Martyr. Here's Clement of Alexandria, the late 2nd century. And they're all saying the same thing. Here is Hippolytus and Cyprian speak of the same practice. So, we've got all these quotations. Now, here's what we've seen. The word wine referred to a substance which could range from little or no fermentation, therefore little or no alcohol, to a substance which was up to 8% alcoholic content. The second thing we've noticed is that the substance was drunk in two different ways. One, unmixed with water, and on the other mixed with a considerable amount of water. This mass of evidence shows that many of the ancients, both pagan and Christian, were very concerned with avoiding the potential intoxicating effects of grape juice. They used both methods of storage and methods of drinking the juice to avoid intoxication. I believe that the true explanation of how we can have two very different views of wine in the Bible is to realize that wine had a range of fermentation from none or little to considerable, and or methods of drinking the substance that neutralized the alcoholic content. Thus, strong drink, obviously having a comparatively high degree of alcohol, if drunk straight, would be condemned, as it is in Proverbs 20 and verse 1. Wine is a mocker. Strong drink is raging. But if mixed with enough water to neutralize the alcohol, then it could be drunk safely and considered a blessing. I think that one of the important things to bear in mind is this idea. Back then, there were people who wanted to avoid the alcohol. And there were those who sought the alcohol. Today, we have the same situation. And the question is, which group do I put myself in? Which group do you put yourself in? If I go to the parties where social drinking goes on, and I go to the house of someone at which wine is going to be drunk, and I go to those places knowing that there it's going to be the strong drink. It's not going to be mixed with water and so on. What am I doing? I'm putting myself on the side of those who sought the alcohol. On the other hand, if I put myself on the side that seeks to avoid the alcohol, to what extent can I do that? I want to ask you, how hard is it for us to avoid alcohol today? It is not hard at all. I hardly ever have any occasion to be exposed any, except in medicine maybe or something like that. Because our methods of storage, our methods of preservation are so superior to those of old. Now let us look at modern wines and liquors that men want to drink. We'll just do this briefly. In Bible days, the process of distillation had not been discovered, so that there was a rather low limit to how much alcoholic content could be encouraged. Low compared to today. So there was a limit on how strong the wine could be. The maximum alcoholic content of Palestinian wines was about 8%. Therefore, the strong drink that the Bible would condemn in Proverbs 20 and verse 1 would have had no more than 8% alcoholic content. Drinks today commonly contain much higher alcoholic contents than ancient wines. I don't know a thing about these except what I've got right here. Appetizer wines, sherry, vermouth, red table wines, claret, burgundy, rosé, 20%, 10 to 14%. White table wines, Sauterne, Chablis, Chianti, 8 to 14%. So that the low range of these wines are the maximum of Bible wines. Dessert wines, port, muscatel, cream sherry, 20%. Sparkling wine, champagne, sparkling burgundy, 10 to 14%. And then you get into the heavy stuff. Whiskey. 86 to 100 proof. 100 proof means that half the volume is pure alcohol. In the days before chemistry labs, the way they would discover if it was 100 proof, they would take a pile of gunpowder. They would pour the liquid, the whiskey, on the gunpowder and light it. And if it would light and burn, then it was 100 proof. If it were not 100 proof, then it wouldn't burn. So they discovered that, and that is a method that I read about how they would know if it was 100 proof. So, you know, if it's 100 proof, then that means half the volume of it is pure alcohol. Some distilled liquors Gin, for example, are almost straight alcohol with a proof of 190, which means 95% of its volume is pure alcohol. Beer, 3 to 6%. Some beers are considerably stronger than that. One can get just as drunk on beer as on whiskey. It just takes more of it. Most people do not go to the store and say, I would like to get one can of beer, please. I'm going to take this home and I'm going to sip on it all week. No, they go and they come out with a suitcase, a 24-can pack. And they're going to do that over the weekend. Or they're going to bring a six-pack home. They're going to do that night. So the fact that the beer only has 3 to 6%, which admittedly is not as high an alcoholic rate even as the maximum alcohol of the biblical wines was concerned, the point is still that if you want the alcohol, you can get it from beer. And you know, I have talked to a number of people who are Christians, but before they were Christians, they drank their beer. I've even had some of them say they cultivated a like for it. They developed a taste for it. They liked it. But I've also had most of them when they tell me that when they started drinking it, they could hardly get it to their mouth for the smell of it in their nose. You have to cultivate it. But anyway, most people that drink beer do not drink just one can. They drink two or a six pack. It is not a matter of whether alcohol passes our lips. It is a matter of whether it is a controlled amount for medication or whether it is a social beverage drunk without careful control of the very dangerous and evil effects of overconsumption. Here is a quotation that will help to enhance the difference between drinking Bible wines and the substances of the day. Now, this quotation is one that just blows me away, and I hope that it will make an impression upon you also. It's a fairly long one, so I've reduced the print just to save space. So I'll read this quotation. Performance in speed and accuracy of reaction begins to decline with blood alcohol levels of 0.02. And at 0.05, control is dramatically hindered, according to a study by Richard Bloom called Mind-Altering Drugs and Dangerous Behavior. It is interesting that in this book entitled that, he dealt with alcohol. Alcohol is a drug. Frankly, it is only because of the prejudicial state of our scientists, a great deal of the medical profession, and the powers that be, that alcohol is allowed to be bought and imbibed as freely as anyone wants to do it. It is one of the few substances that men are allowed to do that way. A half tumbler, approximately 2 tablespoons, of 86 proof brandy or whiskey. Now bear in mind how much that is, 2 tablespoons. Can achieve an alcohol blood level of 0.04 almost immediately. As soon as you have drunk that and it has time to get your stomach good. It takes only 1 tablespoonful of gin, vodka, rum, and some whiskeys like the paler Canadian brands. I didn't know that. I'm just reading a quotation. To reach the 0.05 level. It would take only 6 tablespoons, about 1/3 cup, of modern fortified wine to reach the 0.04 to 0.05 level. 6 tablespoons, 1/3 of a cup of the modern fortified wines would do that job. To give some idea how this compares with what might have been drunk in the first century, it would have required approximately 1 gallon of the 3 to 6 proof fermented grape juice drunk within 1 hour to attain a 0.03% level. Now imagine having that job to do. You drink a whole gallon of it in 1 hour, and when you did that, then your blood was still not up as high as it would with these other drinks. You know, that begins to give you a little bit of an idea why, when the people on the day of Pentecost accused the apostles of being drunk with wine, Peter could say, "Oh, these men are not drunk as ye suppose, seeing it is but the third hour of the day." It was only 9 o'clock in the morning. So, I think that is an extremely illuminating quotation there, both helping us to understand how the level of alcohol is not the only factor to be considered, but also to help us see the comparison between what people want to drink today and what was available in New Testament days. There are several New Testament passages we need to look at briefly. Paul wrote Timothy to use a little wine for his stomach's sake. Timothy was literally a water drinker, meaning that he drank only water. Paul told him not to drink just water, but to drink a little wine for his stomach's sake. There is no evidence whatever to prove that the oinos Paul suggested for Timothy to drink was fermented wine. That is an assumption. We go back to the abundant evidence that it was mixed, that the water was mixed with the wine. One of the purposes served by that, it helped to purify the water that was drunk as well, so that it helped the water to be safer to drink, and the water helped the wine to be safer to drink. The same apostle wrote concerning elders, deacons, and older women. He said that the elders were not to be given to wine. Deacons were not to be given to much wine. Again, we're talking about the substance that could be drunk. But if you drunk too much of it, in the wrong way, at too great a strength, you could be in bad trouble. Aged women were not to be enslaved to much wine. Now, thoughts about these commandments. If Paul had said elders are to be not given to cocaine, would that mean they could have some, just not be given to it? If Paul had said that deacons were not to be given to much cocaine, would that mean they could take some, just not much? In other words, those that would use the wording there to say, "Hey, I can engage in social drinking if I just don't overdo it." I told you this morning that that was one of the views, that social drinking is the idea that no matter what the substance is, if I drink just a little bit of it and am real careful about it, then it'll be all right. And I made the point that that is not what suits the evidence. That doesn't fit the evidence. Is that we had that range, that there were people the strongest, there were those who sought to keep it where it was weak. We have the way it was drunk, one way in which to enhance the alcoholic content, the other to deal with it, to make it where it was not a factor. So Paul was not saying, you know, you can drink some of this stuff that is calculated to get you drunk. He was not encouraging that at all. If Paul had said that aged women were not to be enslaved to much cocaine, would that mean that they could have some? The point is that these verses do not constitute proof that Paul was teaching that it is all right to drink socially of fermented wine. It really boils down to this idea. I've said this before. They didn't always have precise knowledge of how much alcohol this vessel now contains. So when they started drinking it, they had to be aware, now this may have a little more alcoholic content than I'd calculated upon. So what? So be cautious about it. Don't drink too much of it, and from the other evidence we saw, dilute it with water. 1 Peter 4:3 uses three words that we want to look at: wine bibbings, revelings, and carousings. Let's look at those words. Wine trench in his. This word is the one that leads to the drunkenness, which is yet a different word of these various passages where drunkenness is condemned. Trench says that wine bibbings is an extravagant indulgence in potations, just means in drinking, long drawn out, such as may induce permanent mischiefs on the body. So wine bibbings is the idea you're sitting down at the table and you're sitting there preparing to drink yourself drunk. And you're going to keep drinking the stuff until you're drunk. That's what wine bibbings was. I've known people who would take their Social Security check and have a friend drive them to the state or the county line where they could get all the beer they could buy with their money. They'd come to the store, pay off their little apartment bill, pay off their little grocery bill. They'd take the rest of the money and they'd drive to the county line, buy all the beer they could buy with that money, take it back and drink it until it was every bit gone, and have themselves a roaring 2 or 3 days drunk. And then the rest of the month they were sober again. What a way to live. Revelings. Second word, found in Romans 13, Galatians 5, 21, and also here in 1 Peter 4, 3. It may be said, according to Trench, to unite itself in itself both these notions, namely of riot and of revelry. That one is not the one that is very significant to me. The wine bibbings, I think it is. And this one is also very significant. That is the word carousings or banquetings. Today's English version and the New American Standard Version translate this word drinking parties. Carousings, 1 Peter 3. Drinking parties. The New English Bible has tippling. Trench says, notice, the drinking bout, the banquet, the symposium, not of necessity excessive, but giving opportunity for excess. So what's he saying? In the context of 1 Peter 4, Peter says, you did that enough when you were sinners. Don't do it anymore. That kind of drives a shaft right into the heart of social drinking, wouldn't you say? That drives a shaft right into the heart of social drinking. Because it is not something that is of necessity excessive, but giving opportunity for excess. And that is certainly true at a party where alcohol is engaged in. One other verse in the New Testament we need to deal with, and that's Luke 5:39. Take just a moment and let's read that so you'll get it before you. Luke 5 and verse 39. Let's pick up with verse 36. Luke 5:36. And he spake also a parable unto them. No man rendeth a piece from a new garment and putteth it upon an old garment, else he will rend the new, and also the piece from the new will not agree with the old. And no man putteth new wine into old wineskins, else the new wine will burst the skins, and itself will be spilled, and the skins will perish. But new wine must be put into fresh wineskins. And no man having drunk old desireth new, for he saith the old is good. So the point about that is, well, is that saying that all of this that I've been telling you is really not so? That back in that day, what they really wanted was the old. What they really wanted was the old and the fermented. That's what they wanted. Well, if that's what it's saying, it sure does fly in the face of all of this evidence we've looked at here. The point is, the context is of greatest importance here. It is assumed by many that the point is that the more fermented the wine is, the better. And this assumption goes back to what we've already said on this subject in general. It obscures the fact that there are other qualities of the wine to be considered. It can by no means be assumed that old wine is necessarily better wine from the standpoint of taste. Look at the context. It indicates that Jesus' point was that if one has been used to the old, he resists the new. As the Pharisees were wedded to their traditions and resisted the things that Jesus had to say. And in the context of Luke 5, that's the subject. That's what's being discussed. The comment there about the man having drunk old wine, no man having drunk old wine desireth new, is almost, it looks like almost just a kind of an afterthought to be added. I don't really think it's an afterthought. I think Jesus is making a point here. Jesus would not have been arguing that the old traditions of the Pharisees were better than what he offered. Men used to drinking that which had mellowed with age would object to the fresher, stronger taste of the new wine. Literally, they were saying, oh, the old is good enough. But the whole point here is not literal wine. It is a point about the Pharisees and their traditions. Such references as Proverbs 3:10 and Haggai 1:11 indicate that the new sweet wine was a favorite drink among the dwellers of Palestine. Therefore, Jesus would be making the point that whoever preferred the old wine would not be acting very sensibly. Therefore, the Pharisees were not acting sensibly. Some closing thoughts. If 8% was strong drink in Bible days, what would 14 to 50% be? Secondly, remember that the wine was mixed with water. If you took a glass of wine of 8% strength and mixed it with an equal amount of water, you would reduce the alcoholic content to 4%. If you mixed it with two glasses of water, you would have an alcoholic content of 2.67%. So that water would vastly reduce the alcoholic content. Fresh grape juice was commonly mixed. In other words, we're just kind of reviewing the things we've said. Fresh grape juice was commonly mixed with water. If a person who wanted to be careful not to get intoxicated planned to drink wine that he knew was strong, up to 8%, what he would do would be to add much more water. By then, even to get tipsy would require such enormous amounts that one would encounter a kidney problem before he would have an intoxication problem. And yet the social drinking that is done today involves the strong drinks mentioned above, uncut. Suppose one says, well, I'll carefully cut my beverage with water until there's no danger of intoxication. Now can I drink it? You still have to buy it. Most of the people who buy it do not cut it. When you go to the liquor store or the liquor aisle in the grocery store and buy your alcoholic drinks, your influence will be with those who drink strong drink. And you will have it in your house so that any time you would like some of it, uncut, stronger, it'll be there to tempt you. And you'll get more used to the idea. And your children will grow up perfectly comfortable around strong drink, will have even less resistance to the idea than you do. No one knows whether he is an alcoholic until he drinks. If one avoids alcohol, he will never find out. I could name some people, highly respected people, who had confirmed alcoholics in their families. But they never found out whether they themselves would be an alcoholic because they never drank. So, our conclusion, this brings us back to our earlier point that wine is found in two contexts in the Bible, good and bad. The good use of the wine involved the drinking of the grape juice unfermented as nearly as possible. It also involved the mixing of large quantities of water with the wine to dilute the alcohol. The evidence that we have looked at suggests that the good people of society sought to avoid the alcoholic content as much as was possible for them. In passages such as 1 Peter 4:3, the carousings that we looked at, that word that Peter said, now you've done that enough back when you were sinners. Christians were commanded not to participate in situations where excess was possible. That does away with your social drinking parties. What do you suppose such people, as we're talking about, living back in those days, desiring to avoid the alcoholic content, what would they have done in a day of superior methods of keeping juice fresh, in a day of refrigeration, and in a time when there is a choice of a very wide range of non-alcoholic beverages where you don't run any risk at all? Therefore, Christians should do all in their power to avoid the drinking of alcoholic beverages. The Bible furnishes no encouragement whatever to think that Jesus drank intoxicating wine or that he encouraged anyone else to. It has always been amazing to me that everyone, from the gutter drunk to the party sipper, will use Jesus to justify their drinking every kind of alcoholic beverage. as if you could try to picture Jesus in the midst of the carousing situations that Peter speaks of. I'm going to read this quotation from Paul Earnhardt in Christianity Magazine from a few years ago. In America, alcohol has been used as a drug, a feel-good beverage, and the use of the most innocent, non-intoxicating wine would likely be perceived that way by others. We are living in a drugged society where God's child must walk circumspectly, neither bringing an occasion of stumbling to others or shutting hearts against the gospel. Better it is by far that we avoid even the most diluted form of beverage alcohol, so that our good may not be evil spoken of, Romans 14:16, and Christ may be exalted. One other point I made this morning was, the thing is, if you want to drink and you like to get drunk, none of this evidence is going to make any difference. And I know that. What I'm hoping is that what we've looked at will give you the facts about it so that you can make a decision not to get started doing this kind of thing, thinking that it is the thing to be done, thinking that it is something that would have God's approval. I hope that the information will help. Remember that we do have the tapes if you desire one.